Good morning on a Friday, July 10th, 2020. Well, we saw another record day in coronavirus cases in Texas. We had 10,000 recorded new cases of COVID-19 in Texas yesterday. With 105 and 105 deaths. Hospitalizations are now reaching hospitalizations in the state are now reaching the 10,000 mark. That's 16.7 hospital beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients. Houston area, Dallas County, Travis County, and El Paso County have been seeing the largest spikes in the coronavirus. El Paso County has now close to 9,000 confirmed cases and 145 deaths. Close to 6,000 confirmed recoveries. And Mayor Sylvester Turner the other day canceled the Texas GOP's in-state convention, which was scheduled to take place in Houston next week, or I believe. The Texas GOP is suing him. Is suing him over that. I know the courts in Harris County are also hearing cases by virtually. The runoff for the Texas primary is taking place on next Tuesday, July 14th. Today is the last day of early voting. Yes. In the big race and the big runoff and for that this year's primary is the Democratic primary for the U.S. United States Senate between M.J. Hagar and Royce West. Decide who will take on the well-funded Republican incumbent senator John Cornyn, who is way ahead in the polls over both Royce West and MJ Hagar. I'm saying that one might be looking for maybe a surprise, that an upset in that race. Royce West, I think, might be poised for a huge night on Tuesday. It might be poised to upset MJ Hagar. Other local runoff race. There are key races locally. For the DA spot between James Montoya and Assistant DA James Montoya and Yvonne Rosales. Also, County Commissioner Precinct two between Vincent Pettis and Ileana Holguin, the outgoing Deans, El Paso County Democratic Party chairwoman. I feel Vince Pettis probably should be the favorite in that to win that one. And to even though there's a the winner of that race will be facing off against Randy French in the who's the GOP candidate. On the Republican side, there's the big race locally is the runoff for the 16th United States Congressional District in Texas between Irene Amendadas Jackson and Samuel Williams. Irene Amendadas Jackson looks to be the favorite in that race to face off against incumbent Democratic Representative Veronica Escobar. Two Supreme Court cases yesterday were handed down. Two Supreme Court decisions yesterday were handed down. One dealing with Trump's tax returns. The court ruled that federal prosecutors in New York City can confiscate Trump's tax returns as part of a criminal investigation, but said that Congress is blocked from doing so, not right at the moment. Yeah, that case decision was a 7-2 decision. Another case was involved Oklahoma decided that half of Oklahoma is still a reservation, Indian reservation land, where the state law doesn't. State law doesn't have it. Doesn't apply there. Yeah, it's federal. Yeah, federal Indian reservation land, which is basically half of Oklahoma, including Tulsa. So that basically opened up a huge can of worms and probably further legal chaos is probably gonna stem from this case, this decision. Let's continue with our series on the Federalist Papers. Today, read the Federalist number 7, written by Alexander Hamilton, published on November 17th, 1787, and addressed to the people of the state of New York. It is sometimes asked, with an air of seeming triumph, What inducements could the states have, if disunited, to make war upon each other? It would be a full answer to this question to say precisely the same inducements which have at different times deluged in blood all the nations in the world. But unfortunately for us, the question admits of a more particular answer. There are causes of difference within our immediate contemplation of the tendency of which, even under the restraints of a federal constitution, we have had sufficient experience to enable us to form a judgment of what might be expected if those restraints were removed. Territorial disputes have at all times been found one of the most fertile sources of hostility among nations. Perhaps the greatest proportion of the wars that have desolated the earth have sprung from this origin. This cause would exist among us in full force. We have a vast tract of unsettled territory within the boundaries of the United States. There still are discordant and undecided claims between several of them, and the dissolution of the Union would lay a foundation for similar claims between them all. It is well known that they have heretofore had serious and animated discussions concerning the right to the lands which were ungranted at the time of the Revolution, and which usually went under the name of Crown Lands. Crown Lands. The states within the limits of those colonial governments they were comprised have claimed them as their property. The others have contended that the rights of the Crown in this article devolved upon the Union, especially as to all that part of the Western Territory which either by actual possession or through the submission of the Indian proprietors was subjected to the jurisdiction of the King of Great Britain till it was relinquished in the Treaty of Peace. This, it has been said, was at all events an acquisition to the Confederacy by a compact with a foreign power. It has been the prudent policy of Congress to appease this controversy by prevailing upon the states to make cessions to the United States for the benefit of the whole. This has been so far accomplished as, under a continuation of the Union, to afford a decided prospect of an amicable termination of the dispute. A dismemberment of the Confederacy, however, would revive this dispute, and would create others on the same subject. At present, a large part of the vacant Western Territory is by cession at least, if not by interior right. The common property of the Union, if that were at an end, the states which made the cession on a principle of federal compromise would be apt, when the motive of the grant had ceased, to reclaim the lands as a reversion. The other states would no doubt insist on a proportion by right of representation. Their argument would be that a grant, once made, could not be revoked, and that the justice of their participating in territory acquired or secured by the joint efforts of the Confederacy remained undiminished. If contrary to probability, it should be admitted by all the states that each had a right to a share of this common stock, there would still be a difficulty to be surmounted as to a proper rule of apportionment. Different principles would be set up by different states for this purpose, and as they would affect the opposite interests of the parties, they might not easily be susceptible to a pacific adjustment. In the wide field of Western Territory, therefore, we perceive an ample theater for hostile pretensions, without any umpire or common judge to interpose between the contending parties. To reason from the past to the future, we shall have good ground to apprehend that the sword
would sometimes be appealed to as the arbiter of their differences. The circumstances of the dispute between Connecticut and Pennsylvania respecting the lands at Wyoming admonish us not to be sanguine in expecting an easy accommodation of such differences. The Articles of Confederation obliged the parties to submit the matter to the decision of a federal court. The submission was made, and the court decided in favor of Pennsylvania. But Connecticut gave strong indications of dissatisfaction with that determination, nor did she appear entirely resigned to it, till by negotiation and management something like an equivalent was found for the loss she supposed herself to have sustained. Nothing here said is intended to convey the slightest censure on the conduct of that state. She no doubt sincerely believed herself to have been injured by the decision, and the states, like individuals, acquiesce with great reluctance in the determinations to their disadvantage. He's arguing that on the need for having a strong national government as an arbiter and an umpire between the various land disputes among the several states. He goes on, those who had opportunity of seeing the inside of the transactions which attended the progress of the controversy between this state and the District of Vermont can vouch the opposition we experienced, as well from states not interested as from those which were interested in the claim, and can attest the danger to which the peace of the Confederacy might have been exposed. Had this state attempted to assert its rights by force, two motives preponderated in that opposition. One, a jealousy entertained of our future power, and the other, the interest of certain individuals of influence in the neighboring states who had obtained grants of lands under the actual government of that district. Even the states which brought forward claims in contradiction to ours seemed more solicitous to dismember this state than to establish their own pretensions. These were New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. New Jersey and Rhode Island, upon all occasions, discovered a warm zeal for the independence of Vermont and Maryland, till alarmed by the appearance of a connection between Canada and that place, entered deeply into the same views. These being small states, saw with an unfriendly eye the perspective of our growing greatness. In a review of these transactions, which would be likely to embroil the states with each other, if it should be their unpropitious destiny to become disunited, the competitions of commerce would be another fruitful source of contention. The states less favorably circumstanced would be desirous of escaping from the disadvantages of local situation and of sharing in the advantages of more fortunate neighbors. Each state or separate confederacy would pursue a system of commercial polity peculiar to itself. This would occasion distinctions, preferences, and exclusions which would beget discontent. The habits of intercourse on the basis of equal privileges to which we have been accustomed from the earliest settlement of the country would give a keener edge to those causes of discontent than they would naturally have, independent of this circumstance. We would be ready to denominate injuries
those things which were in reality the justifiable acts of independent sovereignties, consulting a distinct interest. The spirit of enterprise which characterizes the commercial part of America has left no occasion of displaying itself unimproved. It is not at all probable that this unbridled spirit would pay much respect to those regulations of trade by which particular states might endeavor to secure exclusive benefits to their own citizens. The infractions of these regulations, on one side, the efforts to prevent and repel them on the other, would naturally lead to outrages, and these to reprisals and wars. You know, he's basically saying that, arguing on for a strong national government would be beneficial to having a strong, uniform trade and tariff policy. Rather than having separate confederacies or separate states, with their own commercial interests, negotiating trade deals. Unilaterally. See, he goes on. The opportunities which some states would have of rendering others tributary to them by commercial regulations would be impatiently submitted to by the tributary states. The relative situation of New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey would afford an example of this kind. New York, from the necessities of revenue, must lay duties on her importations. A great part of these duties must be paid by the inhabitants of the two other states. In the capacity of consumers of what we import, New York would neither be willing nor able to forego this advantage. Her citizens would not consent that a duty paid by them should be remitted in favor of the citizens of her neighbors, nor would it be practicable if there were not this impediment in the way to distinguish the customers in her own markets. Would Connecticut and New Jersey long submit to be taxed by New York for her exclusive benefit? Should we be long permitted to remain in the quiet and undisturbed enjoyment of a metropolis from the possession of which we derived an advantage so odious to our neighbors and, in their opinion, so oppressive? Should we be able to preserve it against the incumbent weight of Connecticut on the one side and cooperating pressure of New Jersey on the other? These are questions that temerity alone will answer in the affirmative. The public debt of the Union would be a further cause of collision between the separate states or confederacies. The apportionment in the first instance and the progressive extinguishment afterwards would be alike productive of ill humor and animosity. How would it be possible to agree upon a rule of apportionment satisfactory to all? There is scarcely any that can be proposed which is entirely free from real objections. These, as usual, would be exaggerated by the adverse interests of the parties. There are even dissimilar views among debt. Some of them, either less impressed with the importance of national credit, or because their citizens have little, if any, immediate interests in the question, feel an indifference, if not a repugnance to the payment of the domestic debt at any rate. These would be inclined to magnify the difficulties of a distribution. Others of them, a numerous body of those of whose citizens are creditors to the public, beyond the proportion of the state into the total amount of the national debt would be strenuous for some equitable and effectual provision. The procrastinations of the former would excite the resentments of the latter. The settlement of a rule would in the mean time be postponed by real differences of opinion and affected delays. The citizens of the states interested would clamor, foreign powers would urge for the satisfaction of their just demands, and the peace of the states would be hazarded to the double contingency of external invasion and internal contention.
Yeah, he's arguing that the need to have for a strong central government that can absorb the debts of the several states as a way of preserving unity, national unity. Suppose the difficulties of agreeing upon a rule surmounted and the apportionment made. Still, there is great room to suppose that the rule agreed upon would experiment be found to bear harder upon some states than upon others. Those which were sufferers by it would naturally seek for a mitigation of the burden. The others would as naturally be disinclined to a revision which was likely to end in an increase of their own encumbrances. Their refusal would be too plausible a pretext to the complaining states to withhold their contributions, not to be embraced with avidity, and the non-compliance of the states with their engagements would be a ground of bitter dissension and altercation. If even the rule adopted should in practice justify the equality of its principle, still delinquences in payment on the part of some of the states would result from a diversity of other causes, the real deficiency of resources, the mismanagement of their finances, accidental disorders into the administration of the government, and in addition to the rest, the reluctance with which men commonly part with money for purposes that have outlived the exigencies which produced them, and interfere with the supply of immediate wants. Delinquencies from whatever causes would be productive of complaints, recriminations, and quarrels. There is perhaps nothing more likely to disturb the tranquility of nations than their being bound to mutual contributions for any common object which does not yield an equal and coincident benefit. For it is an observation as true as it is trite that there is nothing men differ so readily about as the payment of money. Laws and violation of private contracts, as they amount to aggressions on the rights of those states whose citizens are injured by them, may be considered as another probable source of hostility. We are not authorized to expect that a more liberal or more equitable spirit would preside over the legislations of the individual states hereafter if unrestrained by any additional checks than we have heretofore seen, in too many instances disgracing their several codes. We have observed the disposition to retaliation excited in Connecticut in consequence of the enormities perpetuated by the legislature of Rhode Island, and we may reasonably infer that in similar cases, under other circumstances, a war not of parchment but of the sword would chastise such atrocities, atrocious breaches of moral obligation and social justice. The probability of incompatible alliances between the different states or confederacies
and different foreign nations, and the effects of this situation upon the peace of the whole, have been sufficiently unfolded in some preceding papers. From the view that they have exhibited of this part of the subject, this conclusion is to be drawn, that America, if not connected at all, or only by the feeble tie of a simple league, offensive and defensive, would by the operation of such opposite and jarring alliances be gradually entangled in all the pernicious labyrinths of European politics and wars, and by the destructive contentions of the parts into which she was divided, would be likely to become a prey to the artifices and machinations of powers equally the enemies of them all. Divide et impera must be the motto of every nation that either hates or fears us. Yeah, it concludes by arguing that there is a necessity for the necessity of having a strong central national government to preserve the independent sovereignty of the United States. Yeah, the presidential campaign, there was a Rasmussen reports poll that came out yesterday showing Joe Biden holding a double-digit lead, Joe Biden with 50% and Donald Trump with 40%. The Trump campaign has been running ads in some battleground or swing states, attempting to tie Joe Biden to the defund the police movement. And Joe Biden has come out saying that he doesn't support defunding the police, but supports several reforms of policing in America. He's also coming out with a trade platform by American plan, which is actually kind of seems to be similar to Trump's tariff policy. Interesting. I think protectionism is becoming protectionism is now again becoming America's national policy when it comes to international trade and commerce. Yeah, the vetting process for the search for Joe Biden's running mate continues. Elizabeth Warren is still considered to be a front runner, as well as several women of color, Kamala Harris, the senator of California, junior senator of from California, Susan Rice, Obama's former UN ambassador. And Stacey Adams of Georgia. Joe Biden committed during the primaries to naming a woman as his running mate. Yeah, thanks for listening. Hope you all have a great day, awesome weekend. Stay safe, and hope to see you back on Monday.